In the West, we've spent 50 years relying on increasing food yields by adding nitrogen-based fertilizers to our soils. However, it's not an approach that has worked for millions of smallholder farmers across Western and Central Africa. This can be down to a host of reasons, from improper application of fertilizers to high transport costs due to poor distribution networks. Local farmers, agronomists, and scientists from across the world are working together to find solutions to these problems. One of the more ambitious candidates has been pursued by Professor Giles Oldroyd. Giles is a group leader at the Sainsbury's Laboratory here in Cambridge. He is at the forefront of technological innovation in the agricultural sector, focused on creating alternative mechanisms to get nitrogen to plants. Giles has spent most of his career studying interactions between plants and beneficial microorganisms. These microorganisms aid legumes in the uptake of nutrients from the environment, particularly in the uptake of nitrogen and phosphorus. Giles's research is some of the most intriguing and interesting I have come across in the plant sciences. Success with innovation such as that which Giles is pursuing would undoubtedly have huge implications, both in terms of productivity and sustainability in the agricultural sector. Now, for my conversation with Professor Giles Oldroyd. Can you highlight some of the most striking differences between arable farmers in the developed and the developing world?
Sure, yeah. So most farmers in the developing world are smallholder farmers, meaning that they're generally farming a much smaller space of land than your conventional farmer here in the UK, for instance. And they get much less from that land. So generally, they are producing the food for themselves, excess they will sell on the market. But their ability to invest in their farming is very limited because of their financial situations. So when you look at a smallholder farming context, for instance, in sub-Saharan Africa, very few inputs, very little mechanization. So it's mostly labor from the person on the land, planting seed that they often kept from prior years. The seed may be very unimproved, and they're not going to be using many chemical inputs such as fertilizers, herbicides, insecticides, etc.
Okay, so in terms of those, you've mentioned that there's both little mechanization, the seeds that they're using tend to be unimproved, and they don't have a large number of chemical inputs. Mm-hmm. Are those the sort of major limiting factors for food production on farms in the developing world? And out of those three, which do you see as being the most important or the one we should be trying to
Yeah, so if, so there is analyses looking at what's really limiting food production in the developing world. And one of the principal issues is lack of access to inorganic fertilizers or any form of nitrogen phosphorus supplementation. So this is the foundation of the Green Revolution, the ability to apply inorganic fertilizers and still be able to cultivate your crops. So the Green Revolution was a combination of genetics in the plant with the technologies and the lowering costs of fertilizers, that the combination was hugely powerful for raising productivity of our mostly cereal, a lot of our cereal crops. Their productivity increased a minimum of threefold because of the Green Revolution.
Just to make sure people know exactly what the Green Revolution was, can you take us over mm-hmm. like when it happened, what exactly yeah. happened in it, and what was the result, how important was it?
Yeah, so the Green Revolution was happening in the early 60s, following work driven in part by Norman Borlaug, but also people here in Cambridge were heavily involved in the development of the Green Revolution at the Plant Breeding Institute here in Cambridge. So it was a combination of things. It was a focus at the time on wheat, and there was a big problem in rust, particularly stem rust. And Norman Borlaug was a pioneer in rust, and what he managed to achieve was to breed wheat lines that were resistant to this very problematic stem rust.
What is stem rust?
Stem rust is a really bad disease of wheat that massively limits productivity, can completely wipe out productivity. And there are a lot of rusts, many of which we cope with, but stem rust is a particularly prevalent problem in wheat. And the resistance genes that Norman Borlaug bred into wheat have been durable until the last decade, when lines of stem rust have emerged that can overcome that resistance.
Interesting.
So the Green Revolution was a combination of tackling those a really problematic disease, but then also dwarfing the wheat varieties, which allowed the application of inorganic fertilizers. Mm. So if you didn't dwarf the varieties, then you added the fertilizers, the wheat would grow really tall and then just fall over. So it was not conducive to...
Exactly.
It wasn't conducive to our farming systems. So the combination of rust resistance dwarfing wheat varieties, and it was the dwarfing wheat varieties that were driven a lot out of PPI here in Cambridge, in combination with the lowering prices of nitrogenous fertilizers, the combination of all of those things really transformed productivity. And the Green Revolution was particularly... It's most famous for driving up productivity for smallholder farmers in India and Bangladesh and Pakistan, exactly, the sort of wheat belt in South Asia. And it did have a significant impact there. But when you look at, we have Green Revolution varieties of rice, we have Green Revolution varieties of maize, there's a lot of things that have happened that in multiple cereal crops following those developments in wheat originally, that have raised productivity immensely across our cereal crops in many parts of the world. But you look at sub-Saharan Africa, and they're just not benefiting from any of those technologies. They don't have access to the seeds, they don't have access to the fertilizers, and their yields are extraordinarily limited. So when you compare the potential yield, and that's when you remove those limitations from nitrogen and phosphorus, the most smallholder farmers are achieving around 15% of their potential yield. 15%, exactly.
So there's a lot of questions that have come out of that. The first one I'm going to go for is why is it difficult for smallholder farmers to get hold of seeds? Mm-hmm. Why is it difficult for them to get hold of fertilizers when these things are now things which have been within the realms of farming for, I don't even know how long now, but a long time.
Well, so if you imagine a farmer, let's take Democratic Republic of Congo, very, very large area, very little infrastructure in there, so very limited roads and rail network. These farmers are often living long way down dirt roads, even if that exists, so in very isolated regions, and they have very little buying power. So there's not a huge demand, there's not a huge profit seen to be made. So there's little infrastructure put in place to actually get those materials to them. So, you know, the fertilizer is generally produced outside of Africa. It has to be shipped to a port somewhere in Africa. And then from that port, it's a big, bulky commodity. Seeds and fertilizers are heavy, bulky commodities. To get them to the farmer, across that infrastructure, that poor infrastructure, the price just goes way high. Mm. So for a farmer in Congo or Uganda, whatever, any region of sub-Saharan Africa, they're paying a considerably higher amount for inorganic fertilizers than a farmer here in the UK.
More?
By weight, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
How much are we talking?
It can be upwards of double the price.
Okay.
And it's simply because, A, there's not a lot of buying power there, and B, it's the just difficulty of getting those bulky commodities to them through infrastructure that's really not suitable.
Mm. So what's actually in these fertilizers, and if it's so difficult to transport it across the world, why are they not? Are they produced there? If they aren't, why are they not produced there more?
Well, if you don't have a big buying power, you're not going to have a company set up a huge factory to make fertilizers, right? When they don't see a lot of profit to be made. So it's a circular, they're stuck in this circle of poverty where because they don't have the buying power, they're not serviced by companies. And because they're not serviced by companies,
they don't
have the buying power, you know? So they don't have access to these, but And even if there is fertilizers, there are. I mean, you go to a village of a smallholder farming community, and there'll often be a farming shop selling seeds, selling fertilizers. But the costs are just generally above the cost of what most farmers in the region can afford. Mm. So it's not to say that there's no inputs being used and no improved seeds being used. Mm. It is a mixed bag, depending on the farmers. Some farmers more innovative and wealthier can afford to bring those inputs in, mm. other farmers not. And some farmers are sitting in the middle using very small amounts of fertilizers. Mm. So you asked about what makes fertilizers. So fertilizers is nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, mostly. Sometimes you see an addition of sulfur or addition of other micronutrients in regions where those are limiting, but it's always nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. Potassium and phosphate are mined from rock supplies, and ironically, 90% of the world's supply of phosphate is in Africa, in the Sahara Desert, yeah. south in southern Morocco. But most of that is mined and then shipped out into other parts of the world other than Africa. Nitrogenous fertilizers are produced by a chemical reaction called the Haber-Bosch process, and that is highly energetically demanding, but it fixes the nitrogen out of the atmosphere, converts it into ammonia. So that is a process that you're not limited by location, but you do need a very good energy supply because it's extremely energy demanding. And you also generally, these things are produced close to the biggest markets.
And they end up getting shipped out elsewhere from
those. Sure, exactly, from those production areas.
So would we say we would have places running the Haber-Bosch process within the UK, or be okay. So, and that's really what makes it cheaper because they are that much closer.
Exactly. So that enormous explosion that happened in
Beirut. No?
Beirut, yeah. Exactly. Beirut. Thank you. Yes, it was in Beirut. I mean, that was caused by the ingredients for nitrogenous fertilizers that were sitting in the port and poorly preserved. Okay. These nitrogenous molecules can be extremely explosive. It's a port. It's handling a large amount of these chemicals sitting in the port. They've been brought in, I don't know from where else, but brought in from afar, sitting in the port, waiting to be processed into fertilizers and then shipped to the farmers.
You always see the sort of no flames next to the fertilizers on farms.
And yeah, like exactly.
They're real sort of cannon ships, really. But, so what do subsistence farmers tend to end up using to replace fertilizers? Is there anything that they try and bring in there that maybe do a bit of a job?
Smallholder farmers are a mixed bag, as I said. Mm-hmm. You've got everything from the poorest all the way through to a moderately wealthy individuals but 70% of the poorest people on the planet are smallholder farmers. So it's really generally the poorest people are just living off a small amount of land that have available to them. If they have domestic animals, and that is a big if, they can use the manure from those domestic animals. But even if they have a domestic animal, it might be one cow, mm. or a couple of goats. Mm. So it's not going to be producing enough manure to fertilize the whole piece of land that they have. The biggest source of fertilizer is their own excrement that they will put into the land. Yes, generally.
Does that work well?
Sure. Yes. Yeah.
It's just you don't have the quantities you need.
It's again exactly the amount that you're actually fertilizing the land is not replenishing the nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium that are removing. So in an agricultural system, when you harvest off your product, you're taking nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium out of that in your product, and if you don't replenish it, then you're essentially mining away the natural reserves of nitrogen.
Do they ever use alternative methods to replenish it, like crop rotations or things like that?
Crop rotation is extremely rare in a smallholder farming system because it's one hector. Because there are small areas of land, but also because they will tend to grow the really valuable crops, the crops that are valuable to themselves, such as maize, such as cassava. And so often they're planting year on year the same crops, which is not great for diseases as well as replenishing the soil. What you do see in a smallholder farming context is they might do a co-planting. So they might plant maize with a climbing bean, and so they're growing side by side. And that's actually a good thing. You will have some areas where they have plots of beans as well. So you might have some level of rotation, but they're often in large parts of Africa, they're growing a single staple crop year on year, often on the same piece of land.
Okay, interesting. If you didn't see these bottlenecks, so if production, the sort of levels of productivity weren't down at 15% and they had access to easy fertilizers, in that sort of idealized world, where would you, what sort of, I mean, are you seeing like a fully productive Africa?
If you take away the rains, the limitations caused by nitrogen and phosphorus, you can get up to about 70% of productivity in large, many parts of Eastern Central Africa without necessitating further irrigation. So that's just using what's available in the rain. And, you know, in somewhere like the US, or here in UK, we're generally somewhere between 80 and 90% of potential productivity.
Okay, interesting. So do you think you could take a second just to summarize those problems, summarize what you've just talked about, and just talk about the sort of the major points and how they affect subsistence farmers and why they have these problems.
Sure, yeah. So smallholder farmers, a lot of them sitting in sub-Saharan Africa, are among the poorest individuals on the planet, often living in extremely remote regions of Africa. And they lack access to improved seeds, to fertilizers, to any other inputs. They lack that access in part because the infrastructure to get roads and railways are poor, but also because they don't have the buying power, so there's little drive for companies to service them. Their lack of access to fertilizers in particular massively limits their productivity. They're generally achieving around 15% potential productivity. And if we remove that limitations from fertilizer, we can get up to about 70% of potential productivity. So it really is a major limitation to their potential yields. And it just reflects the enormous increases in yield that came from the Green Revolution that many farmers in conventional farming systems, like here in the UK, Europe, and the US, benefit from the Green Revolution, the improved seeds and the fertilizer application that came with it.
So then to go on to what you're working on and what you're doing about these problems, let's start off with what legumes and why they interest you when it comes to approaching this problem.
So legumes are peas and beans. They are a large family of plants that have the capability to associate with beneficial bacteria that uniquely are able to convert atmospheric nitrogen into ammonia. So nitrogen is not a limiting element on the planet. 70% of the air you're breathing right now is nitrogen. But it's a chemically inert form of nitrogen, very inaccessible to most organisms. It's only bacteria that can access a nitrogen from the atmosphere. And they convert molecular dinitrogen into ammonia, which is a reactive form of nitrogen that organisms such as plants can utilize to integrate into production of amino acids, for instance, or nucleotides. So legumes, through this association with beneficial bacteria, can acquire all their nitrogen needs from at the atmosphere, as opposed to the limiting access to nitrogen available in the soil.
Okay. So does it then, in that case, does it require a symbiotic relationship between whatever the plant is and the bacteria in all cases? It's never just like the legume managing to...
Oh no, itself. Of course, no. The legume can't do it by itself. Yeah. The legume enters this association with bacteria. It's beneficial to both partners. The bacteria gets a source of carbon in the form of sugars from photosynthesis, whereas the plant gets a source of nitrogen from nitrogen fixation. And it's an extremely tight association between the plant and the bacteria. Much tighter than many other plant-bacterial associations we see.
What does tight mean?
It means that it's an intracellular colonization of the plant cells. So the bacteria are accommodated inside membrane-bound compartments inside the cells of these nodules that are formed on the roots. And there have historically been similar beneficial symbiotic associations in plants that have been has evolved now to organelles. So the chloroplast evolved from a beneficial association with cyanobacteria. It ceases to be a free living bacteria. It's now entirely subsumed into the plant cell and is inherited in the germline. But that evolved from a bacterial association, as did the mitochondria.
Just to make sure we break down some of the words, but what is a chloroplast and what does it mean for it to be inherited within the germline?
So the chloroplast is an organelle inside plant cells that has a capability to photosynthesize. It's how plants photosynthesize. It's how plants evolve the capability to photosynthesize. Mm. They evolved it because of an association with cyanobacteria. And now you cannot take a chloroplast and it lives as a free living bacteria anymore. It's been present in this association for so long that it's actually lost a lot of the genetic material necessary for a free living state. Mm-hmm. So now it's essentially trapped as this photosynthetic organelle inside plant cells, as is the mitochondria, where mitochondria was a bacterial association also that facilitated respiration and the respiratory process. So mitochondria and chloroplasts are organelles in all plant cells, and so they get into the cells that inside the seed, which becomes the new embryonic plant. So in that way, a parent plant can send to their seeds these organelles, these chloroplasts and mitochondria. In contrast, the nitrogen fixing association is on the path towards that organelle. Eventually, it looks rather like an organelle, and its sole function is to fix nitrogen. So it's not that dissimilar. Chloroplasts catch carbon dioxide. Mitochondria, you could say, catch oxygen, and these nitrogen fixing associations capture nitrogen. But they only form in the root. And so it's not possible to get them into the seeds, the cells that give rise to the seed. So they're not inherited like an organelle in the same way a chloroplast or a mitochondria is. But I like to see them as they start off as free living bacteria. They end up as a terminally differential, or some of them end up as terminally differentiated structures inside the plant cells that look like an organelle and whose sole function is the capture of this gas, nitrogen.
But they're slightly different in the fact that they're not passed down the germline.
Exactly. You can't get those organelles from the root into the germline, so they never get into the seed. But maybe give us another 100 million years of evolution and that might happen, you know, but it's just not how it happens at the moment.
Yeah. So does that then mean if it's not, it's not quite the same as either chloroplasts or mitochondria, does that mean then that you've got to have some part of the genetic sequence which allows for this symbiotic relationship to occur?
Yeah, so
different between cereals and...
Yeah, legumes? Exactly. So legumes have evolved this capability to associate with these nitrogen-fixing bacteria. It's about 100 million years ago, approximately, is what we now estimate. But some of the research that I've done and other people have done has revealed that a lot of the genetic framework that legumes use to associate with nitrogen-fixing bacteria didn't evolve 100 million years ago. They evolved 450 million years ago at the base of the very earliest evolution of land plants. Okay. And that's because that genetic framework, what we call the symbiosis signaling pathway, and what it regulates, is necessary for a fungal association, an interaction between plants and beneficial fungi. Mm-hmm. And those fungal associations, we call them arbuscular mycorrhizal fungi. These mycorrhizal fungi also very intracellularly colonize the cells of the root, extensively, massively infest the root cells, and then ramify out into the soil and help in the uptake of nitrogen, sources of nitrogen, of sources of phosphorus, water, and some micronutrients. We generally think of them as really providing the principal source of phosphate, but it's clear they're also doing other things in helping the plant take up limiting nutrients from the soil. So that was something that evolved very early in the plant kingdom, and because of that, it's ubiquitous throughout the plant kingdom, because the earliest ancestors of land plants had that capability, and so it's present across all the way from liverworts all the way through flowering plants. they have the capability to associate with this mycorrhizal fungi. What happened at the emergence of the legumes was that they utilized that pre-existing genetic framework, which, if you think about it, it was facilitating colonization by a beneficial microorganism. Mm. So it's not radically different between the fungal and the bacterial association. And what we and others have discovered is that a large part of the genetic framework that's necessary to support the fungal association is used by legumes to facilitate the bacterial association. Mm-hmm. So legumes didn't reinvent the wheel. They used what was available and they adapted it to now allow the same genetic machinery now to support a bacterial association as well as the fungal association. So legumes will have associations with these beneficial fungi and the beneficial bacteria, and they're getting, in a natural context, they're getting probably most of their nutrients through these microbial associations. And exchanging that for photosynthesis, which actually came also from an endosymbiosis with bacteria, right? So I like to think of
the whiteboard, really.
Exactly. I think of the plant as just the port. It's a trading place where it's trading fixed carbon for fixed nitrogen for accessible phosphate.
Yeah, that's so interesting. So is then what you're trying to do is essentially, almost to an extent, reverse engineer the evolutionary tree back to the point where that split happens and figure out if there are things that are getting in the way of it happening in plants?
It's clear it was a proactive evolution, so novel. And there's nothing that we've discovered that's specific to the nitrogen-fixing symbiosis. So everything that evolved at 100 million years ago with the emergence of nitrogen fixation has used either this pre-existing genetic framework for the fungal association or emerged new functions for pre-existing genes. And so at this time, it was a period where there was a huge amount of diversification in the plants and also probably facilitated by whole genome duplications that were happening, that liberates the plant to evolve.
What is a whole genome duplication?
A whole genome duplication is where, literally, it's as it sounds, the plant doubles its genome.
Yeah. And why does that help with the evolution?
Because now you have two copies of every gene. If that intermediate can survive, you've got two copies of every gene. So if you change the function of a copy of a gene, you might lose the existing function, so it's difficult to evolve that. Mm. If you have two copies of the same gene, one can stay doing its original function, and now you can evolve a new function with this second copy of the gene. And if you imagine you've duplicated every gene in the whole genome, liberated this possibility
extended your canvas again.
You've massively extended your canvas. And what happens over time is that the plant rationalizes it back down to a diploid, gets rid of a lot of excess DNA, but you always still end up with areas of the genome that are duplicated because they were useful.
I didn't know that. That's amazing that it goes back down towards it. I suppose as it changes, then it ends up becoming different to another.
Some plants can stabilize this multi-genome status, and we have many of our crops are multiploidy, as in they have multiple copies of gene of their. Sometimes it's multiple copies of the same genome. Sometimes it's multiple copies of different genomes. So two plants which are rarely reproduced can reproduce, but their genomes are sufficiently different that they don't segregate together. Yeah. They segregate apart, and you end up with a plant with two different genomes in its.
Interesting. How difficult is it to get this sort of symbiotic relationship working? How difficult is this research?
So we're doing two things actually right now, because the mycorrhizal symbiosis, I would say, has been mostly ignored in agriculture. Mm. You see it utilized in forestry as inoculants, and you see it utilized in orchards for establishment of fruit trees. But in an arable farming context, we're not using mycorrhizal fungi. There's been no improvement in crops for mycorrhizal fungi. And, you know, plants are smart. If we heavily fertilize the ground, so there's loads of nitrogen and phosphorus, why bother trading your photosynthesis products for nitrogen and phosphorus? They just take it up straight from the soil. And the fungus can't survive without the plant. So if the plant chooses not to engage with the fungus year upon year upon year, then your levels of the mycorrhizal fungus just disappear. And that's exactly what we see in heavily fertilized, heavily tilled agricultural soils, the diversity of mycorrhizal fungi is extraordinarily low compared to a natural ecosystem. So we've really, although most of our crop plants can associate with mycorrhizal fungi, we're not benefiting from their capture of these limiting nutrients. And so when we pour on our fertilizers onto the soil, we capture, the crop plant captures very little of those fertilizers into the crop itself. A lot of them are lost out into the environment, and nitrous and nitric oxides are very potent greenhouse gases that are a major source of greenhouse gases from agriculture as a result of using nitrogenous fertilizers. And both nitrogen and phosphorus get into our aquatic systems, and they're very problematic in aquatic and terrestrial ecosystems. They cause a collapse in biodiversity. So if we could find a way to more efficiently capture the nutrients that we apply, firstly, we can apply less nutrients, and secondly, you can lose less out into the environment. So I think mycorrhizal fungi have a possibility of a step towards a more sustainable system. And a step that's easier because our crop plants have the capability to associate with these fungi already. It's just they're not used. Yeah. We're not farming for mycorrhizal fungi, and we haven't bred the crops to benefit maximally from these fungi. So I think that's a first step of using these beneficial associations to drive greater sustainability in agriculture. The harder step that we're also working on is transferring this capability to associate with nitrogen-fixing bacteria to other crops, such as cereals, but also cassava, potato. You know, all of these crops are heavily fertilized currently, or not. In a smallholder farming context, they're not, and their yields are low, versus in a conventional farming context, we're pouring fertilizers on them and accepting the environmental consequences.
Do you will this first step of sort of helping improve nitrogen fixation in cereals without the rhizobia part of it, so the bacteria that would be doing the nitrogen fixation themselves, is it a stepping stone towards that, the stuff that you're doing now, or is it just a...
Oh, absolutely. Okay. No, that's what we're working on, for sure. So we're working on two major areas. One is engineering nitrogen fixation into crop plants that can't do it, and the other is improving mycorrhization to drive its better utilization in agriculture.
Okay, interesting. How close are you to doing some of this stuff? Is this a problem that you actually see being solvable on the horizon, or is it a bit
So the mycorrhizal fungi, absolutely. We're starting our first field trials this year. We're doing our first field work. At the moment, we're doing the preparatory work, but we have lines of cereals that increase their levels of colonization by mycorrhizae, and we know that there is genetic components that are driving up the benefits that the plant achieves from mycorrhizae. So there are very clearly areas within existing crop plants that we can drive the better use of mycorrhizal fungi from the crop's perspective.
When you're developing these lines of crops, is that a genetic engineering side of things again, or is that more bred breeding?
At the moment, we are doing a combination of gene editing and genetic modification, but all the genes that we're using are already present in croplands. So I think there is a potential to use natural diversity through breeding, which would be preferential just because it's easier to get it into the field than a genetically modified crop. But for nitrogen fixation, there's no way we can do it. There's no way we can. You can't breed in something that wheat doesn't do. So it's only possible to engineer that. But because of this evolutionary history of using a pre-existing genetic framework that's already there in wheat, because it's there for the fungal association. In fact, what is over the years become more and more apparent is there's actually relatively few genes that differentiate a nitrogen fixing capability from the interaction with the fungus. So it's not like, you know, at the moment we feel that it's a handful of genes we have to get in there. We haven't got it. We haven't got nitrogen-fixing cereals yet, but we're working very hard to do it. But because of this pre-existing genetic framework, we're not starting from scratch at all. There's a large amount of genetic components already in wheat that would facilitate the interaction with nitrogen-fixing bacteria.
Why do you think it's it's important to pursue research into lines such as the nitrogen fixation part of it, so the actual getting the full the longer term goals and this sort of stuff. Why do you think it's important, or what would your arguments be for that?
So, you know, since the Green Revolution, we've seen overproduction and extensive pollution from Western or contemporary agriculture here in Europe. I mean, there was a period where we had mountains of excess food. It's much less so now. But even during those periods where we're dealing with mountains of excess food, most smallholder farmers in sub-Saharan Africa were living from hand to mouth. They were not benefiting at all from either the technologies that were available in agriculture, nor from the excess food production in other parts of the world. So I often hear this argument that why don't we just sort out the food supply system and make it more equitable? Mm. Well, we've had 50 years to do that, and I see no evidence of it happening. It's not my skill set. Mm. So what I would like to do is empower the smallholder farmers to produce what they need. Mm. And to produce what, when I say produce what they need, not just for themselves, but to have excess to sell on at the market so they can send their kids to school, so they can buy clothes, so they can actually rise out of this cycle of poverty. Mm. And for them, the number one income is their farm. So I think it's much better to empower those farmers to raise their productivity than to dump food aid onto the country when they're in crisis.
Yeah.
Because actually, dumping food aid, it's a plaster. It's a plaster that addresses the immediate issue of starvation in that population. But when you dump a whole load of free food on the market, you actually undermine the economy, the producers, and those producers are the very people who are suffering. So you undermine the local economy, which is the income that most people are getting from.
Makes it more difficult to buy fertilizers.
Exactly. And so it's not to say that we shouldn't use food aid, but we should not see. I think we too often see that we kind of like, okay, there's a drought in Zambia, so we're just going to deliver a whole load of maize meal to them, and it's sorted. Mm. And then the moment it's not a drought, we ignore them. And but actually, if those farmers in a good year were producing 70% of their potential productivity, you create a natural resistance in the system for those farmers. So maybe they have five good years of growth. They can develop a financial position of stability, and then they have 2 or 3 years of drought. Well, they're going to go into that drought period much more resilient if they've got 70% of their productivity over the last 5 years rather than 15%. If you're getting 15 to 20%, you're literally hand to mouth all the time and very little excess. So I think the best way to create resilience in the system is to actually empower those farmers to be producing their potential yields rather than
this repetitively
underperforming in their fields. Yeah. And I think, you know, as we go forward with climate change, that's going to get worse, right? You're going to have more droughts. You're going to have more years where you have a bad production. You're still going to have good years. It'll still rain. There's still rain. But what you want is when it rains, that it grows to the water potential. Mm. Currently, the crop is growing to the nitrogen potential. Mm. So it rains and a lot of the water is lost.
Yeah.
And so I want to ensure that the crops are growing to their water potential, not their nitrogen and phosphorus potential.
That's it's a really nice line, that grow to the water potential, not to nitrogen potential. Mm-hmm. How can people get involved? So how can young people thinking of heading into scientific areas get involved in this type of research? Where would you recommend they look? What would you recommend they read?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, recognize that there's more to biology than medicine. Mm. There's some pretty big challenges that we have to tackle there, because, you know, I think in the plant sciences, you tend to see all this mass exodus to medicine. And I actually think when you look at the next 30 years, I don't think the challenge is keeping people alive for longer.
Yeah.
I think the challenge is to find sustainable ways to live. Mm. And also create resilience in the system, because we've got some pretty scary years coming ahead of us. And I think it's not just smallholder farmers in Africa that should be scared. I think we should all be pretty scared. I'm looking at the news last year and this year, and it's just the beginning. Wait 15 years, wait 20 years, what's it going to be like? What's Europe going to be like? Are we really going to be able to rely on the stable and secure food that we've taken for granted all these years? I'm not so sure. And I think the need to innovate and innovate quickly in agriculture to both drive the system to be more sustainable. Agriculture is a major source of greenhouse gases, and to take those out of the system is going to be pretty challenging. So if agriculture...
A lot of that is actually Behavior-Bosch processing.
A significant portion is nitric and nitrous oxides from the use of nitrogen, plus the energy that goes into making nitrogen. And the rest is methane coming from livestock. Yeah. So those are the two major sources of greenhouse gases. So taking those out of the system is going to be challenging, but I think it's possible. Yeah. How are we going to cope with climate change? I'm pretty scared myself, and I think, you know, we've got a pretty narrow window to address food security over the in the face of climate change, at a time when the population is growing as well, and wealth is increasing, and demand is increasing. It really is a perfect soil.
Not just the amount of food, but the types of food. And,
I think we're at the moment we're seeing fires in southern Europe and in California and in Australia. It all feels a little far away, but I don't think it's going to be long until we here in the UK are really, we are experiencing climate change, but I don't think we've yet to see the true consequences of it. We really have to innovate. We have to innovate in many sectors, but I think more than anything, we have to innovate in agriculture. I think there's a lot of exciting and interesting opportunities to achieve that innovation. So I think, pay attention to more than just the curricula. You know, there's lots of living organisms on the planet, not just humans. And there's many challenges where biology has a real potential to have impact beyond just medicine.
You know, there's some serious stuff that needs to change, and most of that change will come from the innovation. So it's, for me, it's a very exciting area in terms of that.
It is an exciting time because, you know, what we can do in technology right now is pretty amazing. I mean, compared to when I started in the lab 30 years ago to what we can do now is mind-blowing. So there's amazing opportunities to drive change in agriculture, both from a sort of genetics perspective, but also what's happening in agriculture as well. Like I'm really excited about the regenerative agriculture movement. It's really changing or creating a new way of thinking about how we produce food and
what agricultural land is actually used for.
Well, exactly. Yeah, there's a, you know, the rewilding, regenerative agriculture are changing the nature of that debate. And I think there's a possibility to align those innovations in agricultural practices with innovations in crop science. Genetics and science. I mean, particularly for regenerative ag. Should call it innovative ag. Regenerative ag.
Quite.
I should just design a new way of doing, design a new farming process. Innovative ag. Regenerative ag. They are not using fertilizers. They're not tilling, but yet they're using Green Revolution varieties. It's the sort of putting varieties of crops into a system that's actually not designed for them. And nobody's doing the breeding or development for that farming system. So
actually doing some breeding specifically.
Exactly.
For that type of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. I didn't know no one was doing the breeding for that type of thing.
Well, it's not a big enough movement yet.
Yeah.
The demand is not high enough. Yeah. The companies are not there breeding.
A lot of the places, you're still almost at the sort of... almost at the like research stage where they're making their money, a lot of tourism and things like that, really.
Some of them, So, I mean, that's true for rewilding, less so for regenerative ag.
Okay, regenerative. What is the difference between regenerative ag and
rewilding? Is, you know, you're just leaving, letting the land, you're not cultivating it anymore.
Soil conditions.
Regenerative ag started off from no-till ag, no-tilling, and it was because it emerged from the US because of herbicide-tolerant crops. So they didn't need to plow, and they started to recognize the benefits of not plowing. It it's good for your soils. Mm. Your soils accumulate.
Yeah.
And so that's what it's called regenerative, is because it's regenerating the soil.
Yeah, yeah.
So the basic principle is no-till. Mm. I think that's the only shared basic principle of regenerative ag.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's emerged, and it's a movement
you end
that's
up getting like much better holding of water content and soil,
sure,
and things like that.
From and carbon.
And carbon, yeah, yeah. Well,
really important.
Yeah, big one.
Turning your soils into carbon sequestering rather than carbon emitting.
Because
if you're always ploughing, you expose your soils, you lose a lot out to CO2. If you don't plough, the level of carbon sequestration is reduced. But the regen farming system is emerging to be as low input as possible, but still economically viable.
Mm. Yeah.
So touch the land as little as possible. Don't plough, don't fertilize, don't spray. So you get rid of all of this heavy machinery.
Yeah.
You lower all your costs because you're not putting the inputs and you don't have to have all the machinery to put the inputs in and maintain that. So their yields obviously are lower, but they're still economically viable.
Yeah.
But it's not organic either. So it's not trapped into like, you cannot do this or you cannot do that.
Yeah, yeah.
So at the moment, there's no rules.
Okay.
And
which means it is partly what makes it such an exciting, an interesting.
Exactly. For me, much more interesting. Like, I mean, organic, they're totally not open to the stuff that I'm doing.
Yeah.
Regen farmers are much more open,
yeah.
and it's in part because they're starting. They have to use herbicides.
Yeah.
You have to use a herbicide
if
you're not going to plow.
Yeah.
You have to control the weeds.
Yeah.
So you know they're never going to be organic, and their intention is not to be organic.
How difficult does the genetic engineering element, how much more difficult does it make your work? As in, like, the reaction that people have to it at the moment, and also, is that going in the right direction? Like, is it becoming less of a problem as we go on, or is it still...
The genetic modification and the resistance to it is definitely a big limitation for me. It affects what I can get funding for, for sure. I'm often posed with questions. Are you really going to have the impact because you got a GM crop? Mm. Which is crazy to me. It's like you're willing to spray fertilizers all over the planet, but not grow a GM crop.
It's once it gets used, then. Once people normalize themselves to things, but everyone hates trying things for some reason.
Mm-hmm.
Once it's been tried and fears have been allayed then I think it always just takes that adoption time, and you've got a huge lobby against it.
Well, I think in Europe we're past that now.
Okay.
I would say. No, I mean in a bad way. We're past that.
Oh.
It's not that we're just sitting there waiting for adoption because the products are not on the market and you can't grow it in Europe. I mean, theoretically, you can grow a GM crop in Europe.
Yeah.
But the process by which to get a GM crop onto market that the EU has put in place is so onerous that no company is bothering.
Yeah.
There's just and even if a company tries to, they'll just sit there and it doesn't get addressed. So, you know, most companies have given up on Europe as a market for GM and are not even striving to change to do anything about it because
it's
so restricted.
Research that's going on in Europe as
for
well,
sure,
yeah.
Undoubtedly.
Because I suppose
yes.
You can't then go and do your field trials right next door as much.
Well, you can do GM field trials in Europe, but it is much more restrictive than in the US, for sure. But it's just that you're in an environment that's not supporting or seeing benefits of the product, so of course it's not going to be an environment where you see a lot of innovation in that area.
Yeah.
I think if Brexit has created an opportunity for the EU for the UK to rethink their position on GM.
Yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And that certainly what's happening at the moment is a discussion on gene editing. And the EU held a position that gene editing was genetic modification and had to go through the same limitations as a GM product.
What is the difference between gene editing and genetic
modification? Gene editing, you have to put a piece of foreign DNA in there because the machinery is bacterial origin. So you have to genetically modify your crop to get the gene editing to happen. But once the gene editing has happened, you get rid of all of that. You don't need the GM. You don't need the GM piece, the foreign piece of DNA. Okay. It's done its job.
Okay.
You can get rid of it. So, you know, you have a editing on a precise part of the genome because of the guide RNAs. Mm. And once that editing has happened, you don't need the, it's not, so, so the end product is, in my view, not GM, because you've not, you don't have foreign DNA in there at all.
Okay.
You have a bit of DNA that's with a few altered sequences. Okay. In a part of the gene.
So you're not actually, so the difference is you're essentially not mixing, you're not taking like large segments and putting it in.
Exactly. You don't have foreign DNA in your final product.
Yeah. Okay.
And in fact, you know, what you end up with in editing is a very precise way of achieving what we've done with conventional breeding. I mean, conventional breeding brings genetic diversity in, or, you know, and you ended up using certain pieces of that genetic diversity that has benefit. Whereas now we can just say, okay, we know this gene is important for this, and we edit a little part of that gene and improve its functionality.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Biotech Podcast. If you'd like to find out more about the show or the researchers we've been talking to, you can either check out the description on your podcast player or head over to our website at thebiotechpodcast.com. Thank you for listening, and please reach out with thoughts and comments about the show.